ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 31st of March. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. US President Donald Trump has threatened to obliterate Iran's energy facilities, including the oil hub Karg Island, if a deal to end the war is not reached shortly. President Trump claims to be holding negotiations with Tehran, which has denied direct talks are underway, as missile attacks continue to be traded across the region. ABC correspondent Alison Horn reports from Jerusalem.
In Israel's northern city of Haifa, sirens alert a wave of incoming Iranian ballistic missiles. Seconds later, thick black smoke fills the sky. A rocket has pierced Israel's defences and struck an oil refinery. Israel says the damage isn't enough to disrupt the country's energy supply, but it's a big symbolic victory for Iran, whose own energy plants are under renewed threat. US President Donald Trump using social media to warn Tehran to make a ceasefire deal and reopen the Strait of Hormuz, or he says his troops
will conclude our lovely stay in Iran by blowing up and completely obliterating all of their electric generating plants, oil wells, and Karg Island.
Karg Island is Iran's main hub for oil exports and a key target the US could seize in any ground invasion. But Mr. Trump says there's been great progress made on background negotiations between Washington and the Iranian regime. The administration has developed a 15-point plan with its demands to achieve a ceasefire. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei has denied Tehran is in direct talks with the administration.
We have had no direct negotiations with America so far, since the last round of negotiations until now. The US demands have been very excessive, unrealistic, and illogical.
Iran has also defended its decision to impose a near-total blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. Shipping through the critical waterway remains highly restricted, with an average of fewer than 10 ships currently transiting per day, compared with 100 before the war. Ismail Baghaei blames America.
Was the Strait of Hormuz ever closed before February 28? What the world is facing now is the result of the military aggression of America and the Zionist regime.
But Washington officials, including U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, are adamant the U.S. will reopen the strait.
Over time, the U.S. is going to retake control of the straits, and there will be freedom of navigation, whether it is through U.S. escorts or a multinational escort.
It's unclear whether any resolution will be achieved by diplomatic or military means. This is Alison Horn in Jerusalem reporting for AM.
And as we heard, President Trump has been giving very mixed messages about what may happen with the US military in Iran. I was joined a short time ago by the ABC's Americas editor, John Lyons, in Washington.
Melissa, those mixed messages coming from President Trump are making it difficult for anybody really to predict. For example, in that one Truth Social post, the president talked about America's in serious discussions with a new and more reasonable regime in Iran to end our military operations. And then two or three sentences later, he talks about how if they don't open the Strait of Hormuz immediately, we will conclude our lovely stay, was the way he put it, in Iran by blowing up and completely obliterating all of their electric generating plants, oil wells and Karg Island, and possibly all desalination plants. The press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, was asked at a press conference this afternoon, wouldn't that essentially be a war crime of types to be hitting civilian infrastructure? And she deflected the question. So on the one hand, we're getting the reassuring messages, and often when the financial markets start falling, President Trump is able to boost them by giving these more reassuring signals. And then on the other hand, he says that we could blow them up. And in fact, there's about an estimated 50,000 US Marines and soldiers in place at the moment or on their way. So certainly the signals are looking like the war could be getting deeper rather than ending.
You've spent time reporting from Iran. How do you think the regime in Tehran would be viewing the future of this war?
Well, I think Iran would be surprised, would have surprised itself by the leverage that it has on the global economy and on the world energy market by closing the Strait of Hormuz and keeping it closed. That was something the United States planners did not bank on. I think they assumed that the Iranians might try to close the Strait of Hormuz, but I don't think they planned on the fact that Iran would be able to do it and keep it closed. We're into week 5 now of the war. So I think that there's now the very real prospect, which we haven't had up until now, that even if the United States decided now to get out of the war, because this is starting to really hurt Americans, especially at the petrol bowser, that Iran may decide unilaterally, we're going to keep this going. We're going to keep attacking some of our neighbours in the Gulf. We're going to keep attacking Israel. So there's the possibility that Iran may want this war to continue, even if the United States does not.
So despite there being calls for de-escalation from countries all around the world on this conflict, you don't see signs from either Washington or Tehran that that's likely to happen?
No, I think now there's the very real prospect of US ground troops either in Karg Island or other parts of Iran. So unfortunately, all the signals are that this war is escalating rather than de-escalating.
John Lyons in Washington there. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says he wants to see a clearer time frame or objective from US President Donald Trump. Australia is among the countries calling for de-escalation as the human and economic toll continues to mount. Penny Wong is the Minister for Foreign Affairs. She spoke to me earlier. Penny Wong, thanks very much for speaking to AM this morning.
Good to be with you.
Australia has called for a de-escalation of this conflict. How realistic is that when the US is amassing tens of thousands of troops in the region?
Ultimately, the conduct of this war depends on the United States and, of course, Israel and Iran. What the Prime Minister said last night is what we've been saying for some time. This is having an enormous effect on global energy markets, on the global economy, and, of course, Australians at the bowser.
Are you expecting US to put boots on the ground to try and reopen the Strait of Hormuz?
Oh, look, that is entirely a matter for the US, but what we have said...
Wouldn't it be good if we knew as an ally?
What we have said is that, and I said this from the very first day, that we didn't see the prospect of successful regime change being imposed externally. And I made the point, I think, in the very first day, the very first press conference, that historically, we've seen that trying to impose regime change from outside really works.
So Australia would not contribute in any way if the US did proceed with ground operations?
We've made it clear that we would not provide boots on the ground.
Would the military assets that we already have in the region, like the Wedgetail early warning aircraft, could that be used as part of those operations?
Well, our posture is defensive, not offensive. We've made that very clear. We provided defensive capability when Iran chose to attack countries that were not combatants, to attack countries that were not party to taking strikes on Iran, countries of the region. And you remember this escalated very quickly because Iran chose to spread the conflict very wide, 12 countries, I think, in the first 3 days.
How would you describe the current state of relations between Australia and the US?
We are strong allies. We obviously may have differences of views on some issues, but fundamentally we work very closely together across those areas where we have shared interests. The US remains our most important strategic partner.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered an extension of his country's military invasion of southern Lebanon. You expressed grave concerns about this when it began. It's now escalated further. What's Australia's position now?
Well, we remain deeply concerned about escalation in Lebanon, the displacement of so many civilians. Hezbollah chose to drag Lebanon into the war by striking Israel, and we saw the Lebanese authorities, including the Lebanese president, make comments about that, expressing their concern. And Hezbollah must disarm in accordance with the agreements from last year. But continued escalation, we would say, is not in Israel's interest and certainly not in the interest of the civilian population of Lebanon.
There are a lot of Australian citizens living in Lebanon, one of our largest expatriate communities, I think.
15,000.
Is there more Australia can do to try and help people who are physically in danger's way?
I'd make the point that Lebanon, most of Lebanon has been do not travel for a very long time. That I have said over over the course of this conflict that people should leave the region. In fact, we've had, as of this morning, some 10,000 Australians have returned home from the region, and that is a good thing, for them and their families. And I appreciate all the work of foreign affairs officials throughout the region who have assisted or facilitated that.
Last week, Australia and Singapore made a joint commitment to continue the trade of fuels, our LNG, their petrol and diesel. Are you seeking similar formal commitments or formal statements from other countries that we import fuel from, like Malaysia and Korea?
Early on in this conflict, I reached out to our counterparts in the region who are our primary suppliers of liquid fuels. That's where the refined fuel comes from that we use, diesel and petrol. So, of course, I reached out to Korea, to Singapore, to Malaysia. We'll continue to do that. We're very pleased to have Prime Minister Lawrence Wong and our Prime Minister agree a statement about mutual reliability. We supply LNG and we seek continued reliability of supply of liquid fuels.
Will you try and get a formal written commitment to the way that Lawrence Wong has provided? Do you want that same level of commitment from other countries?
We want to engage with countries who are supplying to us on the basis that we are a reliable supplier and we seek that they are reliable suppliers. Now, obviously, physical constraints on this, which is why the government is not only relying on these discussions. They are one important aspect of how we are looking to secure supply for the country. You've seen us release part of the minimum our stockpile, and you've also seen the announcement on Saturday of the government through Export Finance Australia underwriting private sector purchase of fuel with particular focus on the regions. So these are all measures which are about dealing with the supply shock that our economy and our people are and Australians are experiencing.
Is Australia willing to leverage its gas exports if it comes to the crunch and we need to try and get supply and it's not forthcoming for refined fuels?
Well, we believe we're reliable and we ask for reliability in return.
Penny Wong, thanks very much for joining AM this morning.
Good to speak with you.
Penny Wong is the Minister for Foreign Affairs. Here at home, the federal government's move to cut fuel costs and suspend road user charges for trucks has been welcomed by freight groups and motorists across Australia. The government insists the measures won't push up inflation, but not all economists are convinced, as Oliver Gordon reports.
It's a stressful time to own a trucking business.
No servo knows when they're getting fuel at the moment.
Daniel Mobus's fleet of 7 trucks run livestock across the country. He's doing his best to keep them on the road, but the surging cost of diesel is making it hard.
We've quoted jobs at the old fuel price. Fuel's gone up, you know, $1.70 in that 2 weeks. The customers aren't prepared to pay because a quoted price is a quoted price. It's within their budgeting.
With stories like this becoming all too common, the federal government has announced some targeted relief. It's cut the heavy vehicle road user charge to zero for 3 months. Daniel Mubbis doesn't think the measure goes far enough.
The government really needs to step in and drop it a lot more.
But National Road Transport Association CEO Warren Clark says the measure, which means operators won't have to pay an additional 32.4 cents a litre, is a step in the right direction.
We have a number of members that have gone out of business, and we have a number of members that are simply parking up their trucks because they can't make ends meet. So we find it's a great decision by the government, and we welcome it.
The government is also halving the fuel excise for 3 months, saving all motorists around 26 cents a litre at the bowser. Treasurer Jim Chalmers says the move is a cost-of-living relief measure that will reduce the cost of a 65-litre tank by about $19. But some economists, like Chris Richardson, are concerned the move could ultimately leave Australians worse off.
Inflation comes down to too much money chasing too little stuff. And what are governments doing? They are giving us more money.
He's concerned the government hasn't learnt the lessons of the last energy crisis.
Remember in 2022, we already had inflation. Then there was a war, the Ukraine war, that led to an energy price spike, and governments gave us a bunch of money then. And that was part of the reason why inflation was still rumbling away in Australia when the current crisis hit. The politics of giving us money in the current circumstances are very good. The economics are not.
With global energy prices surging, he says the government's financial position could look relatively strong at budget time due to the increased tax revenue the government will take in from Australian exports.
Again, we saw exactly the same back in 2022 and 2023. But the fact that the budget will be better doesn't let us off the hook on inflation. We are making the inflation challenge of the Reserve Bank worse, and there's a chance that all this extra money governments giving us the Reserve Bank may take it away.
With the federal government scrambling to find solutions to the global energy crisis, the Prime Minister has appeared on 7:30, urging the US President to commit to an end to the Iran war.
Conflict always has a price, and the conflict has achieved its objectives that were outlined at the beginning, and I think people want to see an end point.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese ending Oliver Gordon's report. Now, the shooting dead of fugitive Desi Freeman in northeastern Victoria yesterday ends a seven-month-long manhunt. The self-identified sovereign citizen killed two police officers in August last year at a property in Porepunkah in the Victorian High Country before disappearing into the bush. But mystery remains about how he survived the following months on the run and who might have helped him. Nino Bucci is a Justice and Courts reporter at The Guardian Australia. I spoke to him earlier. Nino, is it any clearer how Desi Freeman managed to elude police for so long?
Look, not yet. What police are going to do is effectively trace Freeman's steps backwards. So from that property at Tholgalong up on the Murray River where he was shot and killed Monday morning, they're going to basically work backwards to Porepunkah, which is about another sort of 150 kilometres south of there, to try and work out how he got between the two places, but also who may have helped and supported him over the past 7 months.
And police are now turning their attention to those people who might have assisted him, right?
That's right. Yeah, look, there's some pretty hefty penalties of decades in prison for assisting someone who's done what Freeman did. And, you know, it was quite clear yesterday listening to the Chief Commissioner, Mike Bush, that he firmly believed, one, that police would find people who'd helped Freeman, that there was no possible way he could have done this by himself for all this time, and two, that he had a pretty clear idea in his mind what Freeman had done for that 24 to 48 hours immediately after the shooting. Now, that's quite fascinating because it does go to the prospect, I guess, that police already have a working theory as to how he's escaped from the crime scene at Porepunkah in the first instance, even if they don't necessarily know how he then went from there up to the place where he was ultimately shot and killed on Monday.
Do you think these events have prompted a rethink of how police perceive a threat from people who identify as sovereign citizens like Desi Freeman, or is he regarded as a one-off and out of the ordinary case?
It's a really fascinating question, and it's something I think that is ultimately going to have to be answered at the inquest, but we did try and sort of put to Chief Commissioner Mike Bush yesterday some questions about whether there'd been a change in how VicPol looked at sovereign citizens. We've seen in other state jurisdictions there was a bit of a cracking down on people who had identified as sovereign citizens who were also registered gun owners. Freeman didn't have a firearms license. He'd had that cancelled, but obviously he had access to firearms on the day that police went to execute a fairly routine arrest warrant at his property in Porepunkah. And even though they had 10 police executing that warrant, which is more than normal and does sort of suggest that they'd done a form of risk assessment that suggested they knew there'd be some resistance from Freeman, that arrest warrant obviously went so terribly wrong. And why that was and whether there was enough, I suppose, weight given to the fact that Freeman was a sovereign citizen, someone who, you know, by definition thinks they're outside the law, was he more dangerous than they thought he was going to be that day? And I think that's going to be a really central part of the inquest that sort of drags on for months from this point on.
Nino Bucci, thanks very much for speaking to AM this morning.
Thanks, Mel.
And Nino Bucci is a Justice and Courts reporter at The Guardian Australia. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Could the Iran war lead our economy into a recession? The answer is yes. Today, the ABC's finance expert, Alan Kohler, and why he thinks this could be one of the great disasters of our lifetime. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on ABC Listen.